We're going to begin today and continuing our study of Sefer Shmuel Beis. This afternoon I'm going to dedicate the shiur for Refuah Shlema for a man who's in a serious need, a father of one of my students, serious need for Refuah Shlema, Velvel Ben Esther Malka. Definitely, his mother's name is definitely in the season, so we hope for Rachmei Shemayim. We're right towards the beginning of Perek Hei. We had done a number of psukim in Perek Hei last time, that David finally is king. David is finally the united king of all 12 tribes, and we were introduced almost anew, saying that he was 30 years old when he began king, and he ruled for 40 years, seven and a half years he was king, just over Yehuda in Hebron, and then for 33 years in Yerushalayim. So we're picking up with Parakei Pasuk Vav. Vayelech HaMelech va'anashav Yerushalayim. The king went with his men to Yerushalayim. El HaYevusi Yoshev HaAretz. To the inhabitants of the land, of that piece of land, who were known, at least by name, we'll discuss this further, but by name they were called Yevusi, the Yevusim, Jebusites. Vayomer LeDavid, and presumably, as we'll explain, David was coming to conquer the city. It was told to David, Vayomer LeDavid Lemor, so the inhabitants of the city, either through, most likely through a representative, said the following to David, Lo Savo Hena, you may not enter, you may not come here, Ki Im Hesircha Es Ha'ivrim Vesapsichim, unless you're able to remove the blind and the lame, Lemor lo yavo David hena, as if to say that David, you may not enter here. So it's a very strange phrase that they tell him. Right, David is coming presumably to capture the city, and they're basically telling him you can't capture the city. So many times we'll see a phrase that doesn't necessarily make sense, and we have to try to make sense of it. Here, the pasuk itself basically gives us the gist of the phrase. Now our job is going to be to make the connection. How does this phrase follow the gist of the phrase? The gist of the phrase is, as it ends, Lo yavo David heina, David, you will not enter here. You're not going to accomplish what you think you're going to accomplish. The parallel pasuk in Divrei Hayamim uses a phrase Vayelech David v'chol Yisrael, that David comes, instead of it saying Vayelech Hamelech va'anashav, he uses the term Kol Yisrael because David, if he's coming with the army is now unified. It's not just men from the tribe of Yehuda. And the Radak quotes that there was a mesorah, a tradition. He uses the phrase Kabbalah Etzlam. They had a tradition that the capital city of Israel was always supposed to be Yerushalayim. Currently, Yerushalayim was not under Jewish control. And that he had a tradition, and really this seems to be his first, in terms of what the Sukkim are presenting to us, this is his first act as united king of all 12 tribes, is to conquer Yerushalayim and to get control and to build a new capital city. So the tradition that the Radak quotes from is that the capital city would be Yerushalayim, and until there, and then the only time that it would be appropriate to choose the capital city as Yerushalayim, to make it happen, would be after the monarchy, after the kingdom, after the kingship was set. And even though Shaul was the united king over the tribes, all 12 tribes, for 2 years, for whatever reason, it was not considered to be settled enough. And even and David now is he's a rookie at being king. He's within his first days or first weeks of being king over all 12 tribes. It was already considered to be set. One could also look at it from a practical standpoint, that currently David's capital for the last 7.5 years was in Hebron. But if you're David and you're trying to send a message to all 12 tribes that I would like to be the king of everybody, having a capital city in the land of Yehuda doesn't send such a friendly message. It doesn't send such a unified message. So David, obviously we think that it's guided by this Kabbalah of the what the Radak is talking about, or a tradition. We know that the Yerushalayim and the Har Habayis, Temple Mount, had significance from the time, well, we know it has significance from the time of creation, That's where the world was created from. But definitely from the time of Avraham Avinu and Yaakov, and you know the fact that the Akedah took place there, Yaakov's dream took place there. It had religious significance, but for it to have political significance is very important. And it's Yerushalayim is on the border between the land of Yehuda and the tribe of Binyamin. If you are going to send the message that I am everyone's king, which land would it make sense to have the capital city in? The land of Binyamin, the tribe that's going to be the least likely to buy into David, because they just lost being king. They just lost having Shaul and Ishbosheth. They lost the monarchy. So to kind of show them that I am with you, to select and make your capital city in the land of Binyamin, bordering on your own land of Yehuda, was very significant on a political level. The Yevusim lived in this land when the Jews came in with Yehoshua ben Nun. Yerushalayim, the specific area of what we call the old city of Yerushalayim, was not conquered by Yehoshua. There were various pockets that were not conquered by Yehoshua. And over time, we saw countless psukim describing that the Plishtim had made inroads into mainland Israel. The Plishtim had made inroads into cities and in some of the wars that were fought during the time of the Shoftim, but even during what we saw in Sefer Shmuel, and what most Mefarshim seem to explain is that these were not the Yevusim who are living there now, were not the, by DNA, they're not the Yevusim. They're rather Plishti families that have taken over the city of Yerushalayim. The city of Yerushalayim at that point was basically referred to as Yevus. There was a fortress, which we're going to hear about, that it was considered to be a very strong a fortress. And they are the ones, but they've taken on the name, because the city has this name Yevus, they've taken on their title. So they appoint some representative who says to David, Lo Savo Heina, you're not coming here. So David's coming to make a capital. He's coming to conquer the city. And they say you cannot enter. They say that you cannot enter in a fascinating way, which we have a number of explanations from the Mevarshim. They say the only way you're going to get in here is ki'im, unless you go ahead, hesircha, and you remove the blind and the lame. So the blind and the lame might be a derogatory term. Derogatory term because it might be a reference to idols. Idols which are blind, idols which are lame, in the sense that our tradition is that there's no truth to idols. So the idol is blind because the idol cannot see. The idol is lame because it cannot move. There were two idols that were placed at the front of this fortress that was the stronghold of the city. These Plishtim, this family of Plishtim tried to use a deterrent to try to deter David and his men. Because originally, we know this from Sefer Bereishis, originally there was a peace treaty between Avimelech, who was the king of the Plishtim, and Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu enacted a peace treaty that would last for children and grandchildren, who will last for three generations, which parenthetically we know clearly the time has elapsed much larger than just children and grandchildren. But they were trying, for whatever reason, these families of Plishtim, because we know we've had many battles between the Israelites and the Plishtim, but these Plishtim were trying to take hold of the peace treaty that Avraham made with Avimelech. They even wrote, according to some of Farshim, they wrote down the peace treaty on parchment, and it stood in the mouth. They put this parchment in the mouth of these idols that kind of stood at the opening of the city to try to remind that Jews cannot enter the city because there's a peace treaty. So that's one approach. So unless you're willing to violate this peace treaty, which we're going to see that David is willing to violate because it's not considered to be a violation, the peace treaty is over. The time of the treaty has expired. The other Mefarshim explained that the idols that they created may have been images of a blind person to recall the memory of Yitzchak and a lame person to recall the memory of Yaakov. That towards the end of his life, Yitzchak was not able to see well. Chumash notes that. We know that Yaakov in the episode with the Malach of Esav was not able to walk well, the whole episode of the Gid Hanasha. So these were idols to recall the fact that Avraham's treaty that he made with the Plishtim was binding onto Yitzchak, onto Yaakov, and trying to send the message. Probably the most unique answer from the Mefarshim is by the Ralbag, that they were actually some type of stonework that worked with mechanical gears, that stones, like a stone club or something, would swing. So there was a usage of inanimate objects, evirim and psichim, meaning something that's not really alive, and that you'd have to break through that in order to get into the city. All of these are sending the same message to David of lo yavo David heina, David should not come here. What's fascinating is that we're going to see as the parak develops, in other battles, David will ask Hashem first, should I go to battle? We're going to see two major battles with a larger group of Plishtim than just one city. And it's interesting that in both of those instances, David uses the Urim V'tumim, he uses the ability to communicate with Hashem through the Kohen Gadol, and he asks, should I go to battle? Yes, I should go to battle. Should I go to battle? And then he's even told, we'll see, it's interesting to note, he's told in one of the battles, he's told, don't attack them head on, kind of come around the back. But here, David didn't ask. And we maybe have to understand David's not asking is because this was so known, or this was so natural that this would be the next step that he was supposed to take. That either he asked and we're not told about that, or it was kind of like it goes without asking. That this should be the first thing you're doing is to try to get hold of Yerushalayim, to conquer Yerushalayim. So they, and again, we don't know all of the details, but they make it out like it's impossible to conquer in Pasuk Vav, and Pasuk Zayin just says, Vayilkod David es Metzudas Tzion, he ear David. So they said, you can't enter. David captured this stronghold, the fortress known as the Fortress of Tzion. He ear David, this is now what we refer to as ear David. The Fortress of Tzion, as far as I know, this fortress is no longer there. The tour that we go on in Yerushalayim, what's called Migdal David, has, I believe that everyone's pretty clear, has nothing to do with actual David. It's not from that time period. The city, from the start here in Perek Zion, sorry, in Perek He, the city becomes known as the city of David. Because David himself, right, the Mefarshim point out, Vayilko David. It's not Eo. We're going to see that David makes use of generals, makes use of the Yoav becomes David's general, but Yoav is not leading the charge here. David himself wants to be the one leading the charge, and it becomes known in his city. The reason why this fortress is called Tzion. Tzion means something that stands out. Tzion means something that is outstanding. We know we use it, right? A mitsuyan means like amazing, something that you notice. And that was the natural name of the fortress because they felt that the fortress was not, you weren't able to get through it. It stood out as an amazing fortress. Perhaps that goes back, I don't know this for sure, but perhaps that goes back. Why is it that Yehoshua was not able to capture it when he came into the land on a, we would say, on a simple level? We now know the reason why Yehoshua couldn't conquer it. It was meant to be that the united king would conquer it, and claim it as his city and claim it as the capital city. But kind of the street version of what the explanation could be is it could just be it was a very strong fortress that wasn't able to be easily conkered.
Do we know, was this either like around where Har HaBayit is or down where the Shiloach is?
I'm not sure exactly where. There's a lower city and an upper city. Where we believe David lived was the lower city part.
So it was down outside the city walls, down.
But that's where David ends up living. Could the entire, and then there was an upper part where the Har Abayis, where Har HaMoriah was, where they end up building the Beis HaMikdash. So where, it could very well be that both of these parts, the upper and the lower, could still be referred to as Ir David. What we nowadays may refer to Ir David It could have been a little expand. It could have been slightly more expanded then, when because this is right when he's conquering the area. Where the fortress was, I don't know. I don't know offhand. What's interesting is in Pasuk we don't always get the full story in Sefer Shmuel, and then again in Sefer Malachi. Many times, in order to kind of give the full story, we have to take a little bit of a look at Divrei Hayamim, and the next pasuk is definitely an example of that. Just to note again that this term Tzion, the fact that the fortress was outstanding, so the name stuck, right? We know that Tzion ends up being not just a name for that fortress, but it ends up being the name, the shining name of one of the shining names of Yerushalayim. That we refer to Zion, Tzion, it's kind of become symbolic not only of Yerushalayim, it's become symbolic of all of Israel in a sense. But this is the source of it. So you could even say the source was before, it predates any of the religious significance. It had to do with the fact that it stood out as a mighty fortress. That's another reason why you might also hear the word Tzion, a kever, a grave site with the stone. The stone can be referred to as a Tzion, as a Tzion. If someone's, you know, from a certain community, saying very quickly, you know, if they're going to the, they'll say they're going to the Tzion of this Rebbe, because one of the ideas of having a tombstone is for it to be in a sense outstanding, is so it could be noticeable. First, noticeable that someone is buried there, specifically during a time, during the times of Tanakh, during the times that there's a much, much higher need to be sensitive for where there's Tumah and where there's Tahara, where there's might be someone buried. If you don't have a marker telling a Kohen, let's just say, or even just a regular person who's going to go eat Karbanos, that there's Tumah here, it could be an issue. But it's used to show something that's there as a marker. You could also use the word Tzion for. So Pasuk Ches says, "Vayomer David Vayomahu." David said on that day. On that day, in the context of conquering what we call Yerushalayim, Kol Makei Yevusi, whoever strikes down a Yevusi, Viga Bitzinor, and they reach to the as Mitzvah Sion says, is the tower, which was probably the hardest part to get to of the fortress. A tzinor, we know tzinor is you can use a tzinor as like a pipe. So, you know, when you're standing from afar and you're looking at a tower, it looks a little bit like a pipe. Obviously, it's much more significant than just a pipe. So he says, whoever strikes against the Yevusi and reaches the tower, v'sapsichim v'savirim, and they're able to get to the what we consider to be the most likely the idols that were called the psichim and the ivrim, Sinue Nefesh David, those that David really hated, that the soul of David detests, which might be the description of the Avodah Zarah, because David detests Avodah Zarah. Al Kain Yomru, therefore they say, Iver Pisech Lo Yavo El Habayis, that because of this Iver and this Pisech, because of this lame and this blind existence, Lo Yavo El Habayis, you can't reach the house. You can't penetrate into the fortress. So there's something missing in this pasuk, because the pasuk David basically says, whoever fights against a Yevusi, whoever does this, and there's no, well, what do you get for doing this? It leaves it a little open. So the pasuk in Divrei Hayamim fills in the gap, where the pasuk there says, Vayomer David kol makei Yevusi, this is in Perek Yud Aleph of Divrei Hayamim, whoever strikes against the Yevusi barishona, who is ever one of the first, he's... So it's almost like in the process of conquering, David is turning to his men, and in a way he's incentivizing, Yel Roshu Lasar will become someone who's in charge, will become an officer. That right now I have a new army, right? I'm not just the army of the land of Yehuda, I'm the united army of all 12 tribes. There needs to be new generals and new lieutenant generals and new majors, and everyone. So whoever's going to strike first against the Yevusim will become an officer in the army, and the pasuk notes in Divrei Hayamim, Vayal Barishona Yoav ben Tzruya. Yoav, who we know we know already was involved in David's army. Yoav is his nephew, his sister's son. Yoav was involved in the army in Hebron. Yoav is the first to strike. Vayhi l'rosh, that's one of the reasons why Yoav ended up becoming not only the general of or leading David's forces when he was in Hebron, but even now Yoav was the Rosh Rishon Veruba. Rishon, he was the first to go ahead and strike against the Yavusim in the conquering of the capital city. Pasuk Tes. Vayeshev David b'Metzuda. David settled down in this fortress. Vayikra la ir David, the fortress itself now became known as Ir David, the city of David, as well as the surrounding area. Vayiven David saviv, David began to build up all around the city, because again, this is now going to be his capital city, and he envisions this being the capital city of the country. He's envisioning it forever. We know that it only ends up remaining the capital of the entire country for approximately another 73 years, because after Shlomo HaMelech, unfortunately, there's the split in the country, and the capital city of 12 tribes moves to the northern kingdom. But Yerushalayim does remain the capital city of the southern kingdom of Yehuda and Binyamin, and it remains to a certain extent, the capital city of the land of Israel Ad Hayom Hazeh until today. So David has settled there, and he's building up the area. Vayiven David saviv min hamilo v'boisa. He built from the milo and v'boisa, and as the Mitzvah Sion says, mibefnim. The milo is some type of structure. Either it's an open, it might be considered an open plaza, like an open area. It might also be referring to the word male, which is to fill. Because many times in order to build, what you do is you extend walls further and you fill with land to make area flat in order to build on top of it. This was even done many, many, many years later. That's how Herod made the Temple Mount. That's why he made it so big. The four walls that we have, the Kotel, is not a surprise. And maybe we've even mentioned this. The Kotel's not a wall of the Beis HaMikdash. None of the walls of the Beis HaMikdash is left. All four retaining walls of the mountain are left. The reason why we daven at the Kotel is not because it's the only wall that's left. Because you can go, right? I'm sure many of you have. If you haven't, the next time in Israel, you have to do this. But the southern wall excavations are fascinating. And you get to see where the western wall meets the southern wall. There's actually a corner. And you can see the southern wall. So it's clearly standing. And it goes all the way around. There is a eastern wall. There is a northern wall all the way in the Arab quarter. I'm not saying you should definitely check that one out. But the idea being is that what Herod did is he built walls and he filled earth in to make the top of the mountain bigger so he can make the Beis HaMikdash bigger. The bigger, if you have landfill, you can big. So David did that on the ground level. And David was just trying to build up the city. Again, this has to be, if it's going to be a capital city, you just, while the pasuk is not necessarily saying it, you know, all of the ministers have to be there. It has to be a place where you can accept guests. It has to be a capital city. Pasuk Yud. Vayelach David haloch v'gadol. David kept becoming bigger. David's prominence, the success of the country was growing. He was trending totally upward. Vashem Elokei Tzvakos imo. And Hashem, the master of all hosts, the master of all legions, the God of all legions, was with him. The pasuk puts a great right. We always know we can divide a pasuk into two based on the asnachta, based on the semi pause, the wishbone sign of the cantillation notes. It divides the pasuk into two, and each phrase is complementing the other. That David is going, David is growing, David's being more and more successful, but it's because Hashem is with him. That the only reason why he's having the success is because Hashem is with him. The term Elokei Tzvakos, so we know we heard this goes back way, 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 but the Gemara tells us the first person to ever refer to Hashem as Hashem Tzvakos was Chana. Chana in her tefillah to daven for a child, who's Shmuel, was she referred to Hashem as the master of all hosts, that Hashem is in charge. It shows that Hashem is in charge of everything. Every grouping, whether it be here on earth or whether it be even the, you know, the angels and all the myriads of spiritual beings in the upper worlds, Hashem is in charge of it all. And so here, by using the phrase Hashem Elokei Tzvakos, it's referring that Hashem, who's in charge of everything, he saw fit to have David succeed and to have David be the functioning king. Now, when you are successful in government, so that there could be signs of success. One of the signs of success is recognition of foreign powers. What's the relationship? What's not just what the foreign policy is, but what is, how do other countries look at you? Do they respect you? If they respect you, that is a sign of prominence. While David doesn't need that recognition, it's important to note that it's there. And that happens in Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayishlach Chiram Melech Tzor. Chiram, who's the king of Tzor, which gets translated as Tyre in English, that's a kingdom to the north. It's what basically we would call today Lebanon, a neighboring kingdom in the north. Chiram is the name of their king. And he sent Malachim El David, he sent messengers. He sent a group of messengers to David. Va'atze Arazim, the messengers brought cedar wood, right? The Arze Halavanon, Lebanon is known for its forests and its cedar trees, which do not grow in the land of Israel, but they come from the north. So the king sent this high quality wood, the Charoshe Eitz, and he also sent those who, carpenters, who know how to work with the Eitz. Because if you're not used to working with this wood, you need those who know how to handle that. V'charshe Evan Kir, he also sent masons who deal with stones made for walls. Vayivnu Vayas LeDavid, they built a palace for David. They built a palace for David. That this king Chiram, he sent a gift to David. It basically sent him a palace. But it's significant. It's significant because it shows the recognition. It shows the respect that David's getting from a foreign power. This relationship, again, for whatever reason, Chiram seems to be very affectionate towards David. It stands out because we don't necessarily hear about other kings doing so. But this relationship actually goes beyond David and continues during the time of Shlomo. And Chiram becomes very instrumental in building the Beis HaMikdash, in helping the first Beis HaMikdash be built. Chiram had a long life. Now, this is, I do not have verification for the following comment. I had the privilege when I was in high school. We had a small shul in Kew Gardens Hills, or a Bergman shul called Beis Medrash of Kew Gardens Hills, very, very small. And there was a man who sat next to me, an older gentleman, a Holocaust survivor, and he did not speak English well or even at all. He only spoke Yiddish. I don't speak Yiddish. But during Kriyas HaTorah, at every break in the Aliyah, he was always telling me things in Yiddish, on like insights into Chumash and Rashi. And I would sit there and smile and just nod my head and say, Yar, Yar, I can say that. And the one thing that I remember, because I understood, is he told me, and I don't have any real verification other than his word, that Yehuda had a friend named Chira in the stories in Parshas Vayeshev. When it says Vayeir Yehuda Meisachav, he went down and Yehuda was kind of alone. The whole episode with Tamar. So we see that Yehuda had a friend. That was a friend he sent to try to pay Tamar with the animal. So he, you have to obviously play the miracle card. He said that was the same individual. That same Chira, who was a friend of Yehuda, is this Chiram who becomes friends of David. The only reason, the reason why it might be significant is, some, and even if it's not 100% true, maybe it was a descendant. The name is quite similar. Is that it would explain the relationship, because this is not a new friendship. David comes from Yehuda. David comes from the tribe of Yehuda. He is the descendant of Yehuda. this chira may have some form of connection to that chira, the friendship that started long, long ago when they were kind of just two shepherds out there in the hills, is now continuing when there are two kings of neighboring countries. Whether it's fully true or not, I don't know, but you know that's what Mr. Tabak said. So
I took it. A lot of generations, right? How many generations?
You'd be playing a great miracle card.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah, okay.
It won't be the first time we play that card. But nonetheless, he recognizes, and it could be the connection that we do see a little bit of a connection in Pasuk Yud Beis, in the sense that Vayeda David. David knew, David was aware of the fact, ki heichinu Hashem lemelech al Yisrael, that Hashem had established him as the king over Israel, v'chi nisei mamlachto, and that his kingdom was arising and going higher, ba'avur amo Yisrael, because of the Jewish people, or on account of, or for them, is that when David sees the success of his being able to lead, right? Rashi says when he saw how successful he was being, and that he saw that foreign countries are sending him tribute, that's a sign of success. And David remains humble in the sense that he's saying that I recognize. David knew. He had like an internal knowledge. It's not something that David said, but the Navi is testifying about David. He knew that he did not have, it was not his success. He's merely the shliach of Hashem, which is what a king is supposed to be. And that it's not about, first of all, he understood that Hashem had set it all up, and he also understood that it had nothing to do with him. It's that v'chi nisei mamlachto ba'avur amo Yisrael, that his success is only for the Jewish people. That it's for the Jewish people. He's there to be this middle person. The proper role of a Jewish king is not to take power for themselves, but to act as a middle person between the people and Hashem. And David notices that when he sees the gifts coming. I mean, this is quite the lavish gift that comes from Chiram in the north. Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayikach David od Pilag Shem. David took other women who are considered to be concubines, v'nashim, and other wives, miYerushalayim, from Yerushalayim, or at least while he was in Yerushalayim, acharei bo mechavron, after he came from Chevron, v'yivoldu od l'David banim v'vanos, that these women gave birth to David more sons and more daughters. We'll just read the next few psukim and then discuss this idea. Pasuk Yud Dalet, Ve'ela Shemos Hayilodim Lo B'Yerushalayim. These are the names of some of the children, presumably some of the children that were born to David in Yerushalayim. Shamua V'Shovav V'Nasan U'Shlomo. So at this point, we're talking about not necessarily being born right now. Not in real time, but we're actually listing children that are even being born in the future. Meaning this is some type of list of the children that were born during the 33 years that David was in Yerushalayim. Because having Shlomo in there, Shlomo, we're going to spend time talking about Shlomo and his birth and his mother, and we haven't read anything about that yet. So it's projecting towards the future.
What's the status of children born through the Pelegesh? Is it the same as born through a wife?
So let me answer the question in a minute. The pasuk tesvav, the yivchar, the elishua, the nefeg, the afia, four more names. The elisham, and the last one, the last pasuk tazayin, elishama, eliada, and elifalet. So you can take your pick. Clearly, some of these names are used more commonly than others. But if you're ever looking for a name, I don't know anybody named nefeg, but it's there if you want it. Again, you know, some are more common. You know, I know an Elishama, I know an Eliada, I don't know an Elifalet. So these are the children. Now we see two terms. We see Pilegesh and we see Nashim. Nashim are wives. Pilegesh gets translated in English as concubine. The conclusion that the Gemara makes is that a Pilegesh is a woman with which a man has a unique physical relationship with, but it doesn't come along with the financial security of marriage. The financial security of marriage is symbolized by a ksuba, by the marriage document, that A, says their financial responsibilities that the husband has to his wife during the marriage, and B, upon the union ending, either by means of a divorce or by means of a, if the husband passes away first, that there's a lump sum financial payment that would hopefully help the wife go forward and be able to support herself. So the Gemara says, the accepted opinion is that women who are considered to be a wife have a ksuba, while a Pilegesh doesn't have a ksuba. So she's still in a unique relationship with this person, with this man. She can't be with someone else, but she doesn't have the financial security. Whether or not a son that came from one of the concubines could have become king, I'm not sure. There is an approach that one of the reasons why David is having so many children and has so many wives / concubines is to increase the chances of having a proper heir, someone to take over. That here, you know, if a king only has a couple of children, so then you're going to be, if Malchus, which we see is meant to be hereditary, when everything works normally, and it's meant to be passed from father to son, so if you only have a couple of sons, you may not have a good one.
That's a little weak.
God could have arranged it.
Can I just have one more question?
Yeah.
I don't remember in Dvarim when we're cautioned against wanting kings because they're going to have so many horses.
In Dvarim, we're not necessarily cautioned about having a king.
But we're dissuaded. Like,
in Dvarim, it says a king has certain mitzvahs. One of the mitzvahs a king has is not to have too many wives. That Dvarim states.
Okay.
Not to have too many wives. And the definition of too many wives is 18. Learned from David. David had 18, a combination of 18.
Common law.
What is common law? The Rambam says how marriage works. The Rambam explains how marriage worked before the Torah was given. And it's very likely that for a non-Jewish person, marriage works the same way. That if a man and woman decide to be married, then they're married. And if they decide not to be married, they're not married.
So then, under this, I used to hear the term common law, all the concubines and mistresses are married.
No, so there is the relationship is a unique relationship.
At that perspective, their wives as well.
Right. The Gemara's perspective is that they have the same isurim, same prohibitions that having a wife relationship has, but they don't have the financial security. Now, when you're the Pilegesh,
a step further from that perspective, they are considered wives.
Correct. Now you would have to imagine that when you're the Pilegesh of the king, you probably have certain financial securities that, let's say, a random Pilegesh in Israel would not have. Most likely, the same way we saw that when David became king in Hebron, that's when he started taking more wives. So now that he's king in Yerushalayim, this is a kingly thing to do in those times, and he's no different. To that extent, he's no different than other kings, and that this is how you establish a monarchy. This is how you establish a monarchy. That's allowed. You're allowed to be bothered. It's learned out from other psukim that he ended up taking. He had six wives, and when he had six wives when he came to Yerushalayim. And he increased with the number of pilagshim and nashim, concubines and wives. He increased to another six and another six for a total of 18.
Why would anybody want to be a pilagish? It's not like the same thing in it for them. For the women, they have no security. There's something.
the moment. There's some.
I mean, there might be an element of physical security of just being safe and being, you know, semi taken care of. I guess it also depends what the alternative is. You know, so all of these. I mean, we definitely explained that all these relationships had to be consensual. It had to be. I mean, this is not against anybody's will. So it has to be consensual.
So it's sort of protection.
It could be protection, and you know, it could very well be that, you know, based on what were the economic possibilities. So being a concubine of the king, even if you know you're not, you know, chances are you're not going to, right? When we give a bracha to Chasan Kala about becoming Reyem Ahuvim, so chances are, you know, to have, I don't believe you, you know, it's not so feasible to have Reyem Ahuvim with 18, Pilegash / wives. The mindset is clearly different. Why these women were interested, He's the king. So it's hard.
People other than kings have Pilegash. No, it's not just a king thing.
Right. So again, it depends what is the financial, you know, security otherwise. You know, so is this better than nothing?
I'm also talking about the fact that they were like property. Women were like property. At one point, women were like property.
Again, I don't.
Protecting the property.
Again, I don't know if that's the view of it. I don't know if that's the view of it.
Sorry, we're joking. We say they clean for pizza. Sorry.
It's definitely definitely a possibility. But with, you know, with having more kids, though, that makes more crumbs. You know, with the kids come the crumbs. The most, I believe, it's determined that most of the newer relationships that began in Yerushalayim were more pilagshim than wives. Although we know definitely that Bathsheba, who's the mother of Shlomo, who we'll read about a lot, is. Was considered to be a wife.
The common man in that time was allowed.
According to the Torah, a man can have two wives. I think that includes Pilegesh. Again, the Pilegesh, there's no ksuba. So you're gonna, you know, maybe you need to be in a more of a restricted financial situation to want to enter into such an arrangement.
Like one wife, one Pilegesh, or two wives, and no more than that.
As far as we haven't practiced these laws in a long time. So, but it's always challenging to take our mindset of how we view marriage in. It's hard to have our mindset how we view marriage and view marriages of 300 years ago, let alone 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. Pasuk Yud Zayin. Vayishmu plishtim ki mashchu es David lemelech al Yisrael. The plishtim heard that David had been anointed as king over all of Israel. So how did the plishtim hear that? Well, first of all, we read they could have heard from their cousins who just got, they could have heard about the destruction of their cousins in Yerushalayim. We said that the Yevusim were not native Yevusim, they were rather plishtim. But the plishtim now in general, it spread that David has been anointed as the united king of Israel. Vayalu kol plishtim levakish es David. So the plishtim see this as an opportunity to take out the new king. Vayishma David vayered el mitzuda. David heard this, he went down to the fortress. Not necessarily, it may refer to the fortress that David had been in. And this, meaning the one that he had captured, which would maybe actually be a proof. You were trying to before think if it meant if it was up or down. Here it says Vayered El Mitzuda, that he went down to the fortress. And he saw that there's a battle coming. Because Pasuk Yeches says, Uplishtim Ba'u, the Plishtim were coming, they were advancing. Vayinachu Be'emek Rifa'im. They had spread out in Emek Rifa'im. Emek Rifa'im is very close to where the street today is Emek Rifa'im. In the Baca area of Jerusalem today, that's where the Plishtim encamped. And it kind of, it shows us still, even though we're at the same time we're saying how David is the united king and he's growing, at the same time, at this, before David handles the situation, the Plishtim were still a real threat to mainland Israel. That here they are, this is the new capital city, and the Plishtim are able to advance basically up until the border of this new capital city. But here we see, Pasuk Yotes, Vayishal David v'Hashem lemor, David asked, David inquired of Hashem through the means of the Urim v'Tumim, through the means of the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, that we'll read about in this week's Parsha and Tetzaveh. So David asked of Hashem the following question. Ha'ale el Plishtim. Should I go up against the Plishtim? Hasitneim biyadi, will you deliver them into my hands? That was the question. Vayomer Hashem el David, ale. You should go up. Hashem says to David, go up. Ki nason etain, es haplishtim yadecha, I will, double language of naton etain, I will surely give over, I will definitely give over, deliver the plishtim into your hands, meaning you will be successful in, again, this is now, you know, while the this is going to be the official, this is the first real war, a real battle. You know, David taking over one small town, that, you know, that's almost like a military exercise. This is a war with the Plishtim. And we had, again, the Plishtim represents, since the time period of the Shoftim, throughout all Sefer Shoftim, the and Sefer Shmuel, up until this point, the constant thorn in the side of the Jews is the Plishtim. If it's in the Shoftim, it's every 20 years the Plishtim come again. Every once in a bit here, we see the Plishtim come back again. And David has fought against the Plishtim. But previously he fought against the Plishtim as a soldier in Shaul's army. Now he's fighting against the Plishtim as the commander-in-chief, as the king of the entire Jewish army. Pasuk Chaf. Vayavo David beval piratzim. David came to a place called Baal Piratzim. Vayakim sham David. David struck them there. Vayomer, and he said, Paratz Hashem es oivai lefanai kiperetz mayim. Hashem has caused a breach into my enemies before me, kiperetz mayim, like a breach, like water, you know, causing a hole through some type of blockage. The same way that a hole would, right? Imagine a hole developing in a dam and the water rushing through. That's how Hashem has allowed me to make a hole, a breach through my enemies. Al kein kara shem hamakom ahu Baal Piratzim. Therefore, they named that area Baal Piratzim as a tribute to the victory that Hashem caused. So here you have military battle number one, and David is successful. And again, he specifically asked Hashem first, will he be successful? Should he go up? Will he be successful? And presumably, had Hashem told him not to, he wouldn't have. Which is already something that we see David being obedient. We see David asking and David listening, which sounds basic, but in the back of our minds, we know of Shaul's lack of listening. And so we kind of compare, through these stories, we're comparing, this is the beginning, we saw Shaul in the beginning of his monarchy, and now we're seeing David in the beginning of his monarchy. Pasuk of Aleph, Vayazvu sham es atzabehem. They left there, meaning the Plishtim left there es atzabehem, their idols. Vayisaim David v'anashav, and David and his men, Vayisa'im. So how would you translate the word Vayisa'im? So the Shorish Nun Sin Aleph, Nasa, means to lift or to carry. If you have it, the Metsudos Tzion defines this word as Visorfam, to burn them. It's a little curious because if the Pasuk wanted to send the message that David and his men took these idols and burnt them, so say, the Pasuk could say the word Vayisarfam, and he burnt them. So therefore that leads to a number of explanations. Because to say that David and his men took the idols and just lift them up and took them to keep them. So you can't, the halakhic problem is that you're not allowed to keep idols as part of the spoils of war. And we have no reason at this point in time to think that David and his men, chas v'shalom, secretly worship idols. There's no indication of anything of the sort. So why is it that they're lifting them up if they're really meant to burn them and destroy them? So one explanation is that they brought them back. They brought them back to the capital city, to Yerushalayim. They put them on display to show what they had captured, to show almost, you maybe would say almost to show, look at the Plishtim, right? When the Plishtim, at their worst, at their weakest moment, look what they abandoned. They abandoned their gods. They abandoned their gods. Why did they abandon their gods? Well, if you really believe in your God, you don't abandon them. You don't abandon your God. It must mean that they, you know, their gods are not true gods. Our God is a true God. And then, when they were gathered in the city, then David publicly destroyed these idols. The other explanation is that if the one who theoretically believes in the idol denounces the validity of said idol, that could remove the avodah zarah status of the idol. Let's say the idol is something valuable. It's an idol made out of gold or silver, something that's of a value. So even someone like us, even if we don't believe in idols, we still would want, who wouldn't want a piece of gold, a piece of silver? Melt it down and turn it into a piece of jewelry. That's only if it doesn't have the status of avodah zarah. So one of the approaches is that some of the Plishtim had denounced these idols. They lost their significance out of avodah zarah, and now it's a pile of metal. So vayisaim David vanashav, they took it back. They took it back as some of the spoils of war. This was the first battle with the Plishtim. But it wasn't over yet. The Plishtim regrouped. Pasuk Chaf Beis. Just a few more. Vayasifu od Plishtim la'alos vayinatshu be'emek Rifaim. The Plishtim were able to regroup. They gathered up again to spread up and to rise up at Emek Rifaim, the same location of the previous battle. Pasuk Chaf Gimel, once again. Vayishal David b'Hashem. David asks of Hashem. Vayomer, and Hashem responded, Lo sa'ale. You shouldn't go up, which is understood as attack them head on. Hasev el acharehem. You should try to go around and attack them from the back. Uvas lehem imul b'cha'im. And you will come to them opposite these trees, opposite these mulberry trees, and that's how you're going to attack them. That it seems to be counter what David wants to do, because this is almost a repeat of the previous battle. In the previous battle, David fought them head on, and David was victorious. So if he's going to have another episode of the battle, David would expect to do the same exact thing, and he'll be victorious again. But Hashem here tells him, and as some of Farshim understand, Hashem's testing David. He's giving David military instructions, saying, follow these military instructions. Not only saying, follow these military instructions, and if you do, you'll be successful, but follow these military instructions, because I want to see if you follow my instructions. Similar to some of the things that Shaul was commanded to do, where it didn't necessarily make sense, right? With Shaul's first command of waiting the 7 days before fighting the Plishtim and waiting for Shmuel to come in order to bring Karbanos, and then you would go through battle, that did not seem to be the military, the wise thing to do on a military level, right? Shaul was losing men by the second, and if he didn't attack, he was going to have no one left. And he went ahead, and he unfortunately didn't listen to that tzivui from Hashem. This also maybe did not make sense to David on a military level, but it was Hashem's way of seeing if David would listen. And then he's given a sign. In Pasuk Chaf Dalet, Hashem, this is still in the response, right? You're going to attack them from the back. Vayhi kishma achayas kol tza'ada b'rashay habecha'im. When you hear a sound, that almost sounds like marching, coming from the trees, right? As the wind blows through the trees, it's going to make a certain sound, a sound to you that sounds like marching. Oz techaratz, then you could shout out your battle cry. Ki oz yatza Hashem afonecha, because at that point Hashem will go out before you. La'akos b'machane plishtim, to attack the camp of the plishtim. That there was going to even be a signal of when you should attack, right? That you are not in control of this battle. Because when you fight battles and Hashem is with you, you don't have to be in control of the battle. Hashem can be in control of the battle, and you're just the shliach. So that was the message, and I guess we'll wait to see how David listened. But he did listen, so we could end on a positive. We'll continue Rez Hashem next week.